This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. ArcelorMittal has just put out its 2018 United States Integrated Report, which is entitled Innovating for Impact. In fact, it's the 10th year they've been able to put these reports out, and we have with us to talk about it the head of corporate responsibility for ArcelorMittal Americas, Beth Spurgeon. Beth, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Well, let's take a look at the global picture of how the company is done here that's based in the full report. You can give us highlights, but fill us in on how ArcelorMittal seems to have done in looking at all of the various aspects, not only of the business, but I guess its stewardship and all the many ways that ArcelorMittal does its stewardship these days.
Yes, well, ArcelorMittal is the largest steel and mining company in the world, and globally we have almost 200,000 employees across 60 countries. In the United States, as you mentioned, we just launched our 2018 United States Integrated Report. And in this, we're really looking at sustainability reporting in the United States and a continuation of our dedication to stakeholder transparency. So for us, this report is utilized to communicate with our stakeholders on corporate responsibility and sustainability initiatives, which links what we call our 10 sustainable development outcomes to our business outcomes and financial drivers. And to get a little bit into our outcomes that launched in 2015, our 10 sustainable development outcomes are a framework of how we really measure our sustainable actions across our business, both in the world and in the United States.
A lot of this, I know, has to do with not only getting products, or raw materials, prepared to be able to turn them into products that leave the mill and go out for final finishing, and then going out to on the rail cars and on the boats and all to wherever the end markets are going to be. Throw some figures at us here on how the company did here in the last report on the great materials brought in and the great materials sent out.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in 2018, ArcelorMittal in the United States produced 14.9 million tons of raw steel and shipped a broad range of steel products into both the automotive, construction, pipe and tube, appliance, even container, energy, and machinery markets. 98% of our production is in our flat operations, a primarily integrated steel production facilities, such as our facilities in Northwest Indiana. And through that, there are so many really great points that came out of 2018 that we like to talk about in the United States. For instance, we had $10.7 billion in economic contribution throughout the United States. Breaking this down, we have about 18,000 hardworking men and women who work in our facilities throughout the United States, and that's $2.3 billion through wages and benefits alone.
Mm-hmm.
We also look at things like our safety record, which is really of the utmost importance to us as a company. We're pleased to report that our safety rate, our LTI rate of what we call lost time injury rate, was our best on record and improved 31% over 2017. Of course, our work is never done until we have an incident-free workplace, but we're really proud of that for 2018. Another thing that I really like to highlight is our energy projects. We have 30 energy projects in 2018 in the United States that actually saved enough energy to power 11,600 homes for a year. It's pretty exciting because not only is that saving money for the company, for this year it was $15.9 million that's actually saved for the company, but then we're actually also doing more for the environment and our local communities.
Now, going back to the lost time information that you gathered together for the report, we know obviously steelmaking is a very dangerous industry. It has always been, ever since it was created back in the early 20th century, or maybe even before then, I guess. But in particular, here in Northwest Indiana and the ArcelorMittal system as well, contributions do the automating and making things more modern these days contribute to helping create fewer job injuries, and opportunities that could come up into lost time?
Absolutely. You know, we're definitely not the steel industry that you might think of from your grandfather or grandmother's days. Technology has played a critical part into ensuring that we are as safe an environment as we can be. And that's really about what the theme of our report is, innovating for impact. It's about all of our innovations throughout our company and how we're continually becoming better through it. So while we are always committed to being safer than ever before, I think it's something that we can always learn from. One of the really cool things that we're doing, just as a fun example, is we're actually having employees go through trainings right now in virtual reality, so that they can see and experience and possibly even make the mistakes in a confined environment, so that when they're really on the job, they perform in the safest way possible at all times.
Does this have to do in large part with some of the training that has been established over the years, working with local trade groups and helping work with ArcelorMittal to get people better prepared for jobs so that they are not only more knowledgeable about the skills that they're learning, but about the safety things as well?
Absolutely. You know, as part of our investment in the community, throughout the United States last year, we invested $6.9 million in grants and employee matching donations, the majority of which, over 40%, goes into STEM education. And that really plays into the full pipeline of education in our communities. It's not just the youth in middle school and high school that we're preparing, as well as trying to get more people that are in minority groups, and women especially, into our company, but as well as then working with community colleges through our Steelworker for the Future program, or local colleges through our community campus partnership program. We are looking at really filling that pipeline, and in that process, educating that not only is steel highly technical and highly advanced, but also talking to them about the safe nature of steel today and really the fact that it's a sustainable material for tomorrow.
We're talking with Beth Spurgeon. She's the head of corporate responsibility for ArcelorMittal Americas. And we're talking about the 2018 United States Integrated Report, which is called Innovating for Impact. We've talked here about the system-wide impact from the report noted and all the facts and figures. But let's take a closer look at Northwest Indiana. Beth, fill us in on how the Northwest Indiana ArcelorMittal operations seem to fit in with trying to achieve all of these outcomes that's in the Integrated Report.
Well, I would say I'd love to start with just talking about our, even things like our capital expenditures. You know, in terms of CapEx, our Northwest Indiana operations account for 19 out of 25 of our largest capital investment projects in our U.S. operations. In total, we invested $348 million into our U.S. operations. But big Northwest Indiana projects included our Indiana Harbor basic oxygen furnace vessel reline, our Burns Harbor powerhouse rebuild, and our Burns Harbor hot strip furnace replacement. Mm-hmm. So lots of local investment into making sure, again, that we produce the best steel and the safest and most sustainable steel in our local communities. We also are really dedicated into ensuring that we are investing in the local communities when it comes to our supply chain, and especially into diverse supply chains. So a great example that we highlight in the report is a women-owned company called Refractory Service Company, which is a key supplier of refractories to ArcelorMittal facilities. And this is all part of our $285 million total spend on minority women and veteran enterprises in the U.S.
And which for folks that are not familiar with the term refractories, referring basically to the fire brick, the materials that are fireproof that line the inside of the furnaces.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, as I mentioned earlier, in STEM partnerships, we have a strong investment in STEM partnerships and in community investment in Northwest Indiana in general. While we did spend $6.9 million on community investment across the board, the majority of that does go into our Northwest Indiana and Calumet region. Overall, 59% of our total spending goes into the Calumet region. And we look at specific partnerships where we're elevating local communities. A great example is in an effort to expose local youth, particularly women, to STEM. We have a program with Northwest Indiana grantees with Science Olympiad and the Girl Scouts of Greater Chicago and Northwest Indiana. And this is the idea of bringing groups together in order to partner with local industries, partner with local professionals, and elevate the entire impact. One last thing that I would love to bring up that we're particularly proud of in Northwest Indiana is that two of our facilities, both ArcelorMittal Burns Harbor and ArcelorMittal Global Research and Development, were recognized for environmental stewardship through the Wildlife Habitat Council certification process. That's in recognition of land conservation that we actually do on our property. So when we do environmental investments, it's not just about conservation or restoration in our local communities, but also, we own lots of land, and how can we really do wonderful things on it, like restoring dune and swale? As an example, in Burns Harbor, we've restored over 40 acres of on-site dune and swale habitat and created an employee walking trail on our physical property.
Now, finally, Beth, taking a look at how the future is for ArcelorMittal's, and particularly here in Northwest Indiana, if we go through the rest of this calendar year and look ahead to 2020, how do things shape up based on everything that is in the Innovating for Impact report?
I'm really excited about what's continuing to come in our company. I think we're a company right now that is in the place of understanding how important sustainability is, not only for our company, but for our local communities and our planet. And in talking about those 10 sustainable development outcomes, I think you'll see very exciting things to come when it comes to how much more we can continue to report on in our transparency with the goals that we're setting towards things like environmental improvement or STEM education and health and safety of our employees, as well as continued transparency when it comes to our financial impact and how we contribute to making the Northwest Indiana, as well as the United States region in general, a wonderful place to live and work.
Now, Beth, we know this is a very big report that's come out here from ArcelorMittal Americas. And if anybody was interested in looking into this entire report more, which is entitled Innovating for Impact, how can they take a look at it?
The best place to go is to go to our website, which is www.usa.arcelormittal.com, and go to the sustainability section. Mm-hmm. And the entire report is located under our sustainability section of our United States website. But the full, as you said, very long 130-page report is fully downloadable as well. And we're also creating executive summaries and shorter versions for people if they would like it.
That's great. You can watch the website to find all that information when it pops up there, too. That's great. Well, Beth, thank you very much for spending time to go over the report and especially how the impact that ArcelorMittal has here on Northwest Indiana. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Chris. Have a great day.
Thank you. Beth Spurgeon is head of corporate responsibility for ArcelorMittal Americas. One of the other major accomplishments that ArcelorMittal did in 2018 was to work out a new contract with its steelworkers. We first go back to last fall on Regionally Speaking's Reporters Roundtable Thursday to Times business reporter Joseph Peet's early look at the contract talks.
There is definitely the potential of the largest strike since 1986 in the domestic steel industry. Workers are pretty upset right now. There was a, during the last contract negotiations in 2015, the steel industry was kind of in a dark time. There were record levels of imports. It was there were layoffs like left and right. Chicago Tin got idled for a while. It was just dark. So the steelworkers had agreed, they're going to, they're going to accept frozen pay. They were going to make all these concessions to help make the steel companies like survive and profitable again. And they've led the charge on getting tariffs to, protect the steel industry, which has been an ongoing process. And they have, they propose, like, with ArcelorMittal's case, consolidating all the healthcare plans. They ended up saving the company a bunch of money that way. And then they assumed it's a very cyclical industry, so the assumption was they're making sacrifices then in the dark time, and when times got good, then they would share in the benefits and share in the rewards. Especially with Section 232 tariffs, steel prices are over like $900 a ton. The industry is like very profitable. ArcelorMittal just turned a $1.8 billion profit in the second quarter. U.S. Steel turned around $200 million, I think. And, everybody's doing pretty well in the U.S. steel industry right now for the first time in years. And however, when they went to the negotiating table, the steelworkers assumed, they'd go in with more leverage and so on. But the companies came out demanding concessions. They want to shift a lot of the healthcare costs to workers. In the case of ArcelorMittal, I think it's as much as like $8,000 in additional out-of-pocket costs that they, steelworkers would have to pay. They're saying even with some of the tepid pay increases the companies are proposing, some workers would end up losing money in terms of total compensation. And they're just very upset with all the concessions that the steelworkers are asking for, and the steelworkers are saying on their side that they need to be competitive. They need to be competitive with mini mills. It's an international market for steel. They need to kind of keep, their labor costs within line, and they're facing all kinds of pressures, both domestically from mini mills and internationally from all these importers of steel like China and Turkey and so on. And, they got to watch their costs to stay in business. U.S. Steel employees voted nationally overwhelmingly to authorize a strike if they can't reach some kind of agreement with U.S. Steel, and ArcelorMittal steelworkers will be going on Monday to the union halls for the strike vote. Locally in Gary, East Chicago, and Portage, it was unanimous, I think, in pretty much every case where U.S. steel workers had voted. They were particularly upset that U.S. Steel had proposed getting rid of traditional pay increases in the last 3 years of a six-year contract and switching mainly toward profit-sharing bonuses, which may or may not materialize, and which local steelworkers have been promised before and never actually gotten. So they were very reluctant about that, and then the healthcare, they're just looking to preserve the healthcare that they've won through, you know, years and years of collective bargaining, and not have all the shifts to local families. It doesn't guarantee a work stoppage. They went back to Pittsburgh. The USW went back to Pittsburgh yesterday, mm-hmm. and they resumed negotiations. US Steel came out with an immediate new contract proposal. They're saying it includes like $19,000 in bonuses, a 4% raise upfront, 2% raises for the next 5 years. USW has a lot of concerns with it. It would double healthcare costs, but they're saying, you know, this will end up costing workers a lot more in the long run.
And that was on September 19th. Now, fast forward to October 4th, and Joe's with us again on Reporters Roundtable Thursday with the Steelworkers, Steelmakers Negotiations Update.
Both ArcelorMittal and US Steel are expecting big profits this year, and the steelworkers have been hoping to share in that in the contract talks they've been having with both companies. And USW has reported progress toward its goals in with both US Steel and Arcelor recently. Both of them are offering, I believe Arcelor, as of last week, they said the total increase in pay they're proposing over 3 years is close to 10% cumulatively, and U.S. Steel is saying over 6 years it's cumulatively proposing up to 18% increases in pay. The union has been more pleased recently. The tone has kind of shifted in how they're talking about it because the companies have backed off to some extent some of the cuts they've been proposing. They've been proposing kind of gutting healthcare, especially, which workers are extremely concerned about because it's a very, very dangerous profession and, you know, potentially deadly sometimes. And that, you know, taking away healthcare and increasing out-of-pocket expenses by thousands of dollars a year is something they find very, very unpalatable.
So you get the impression that with this news here, as far as what the companies and the union have worked out, that will lessen the possibility of a possible strike?
It's still definitely possible. The membership is very fired up and very engaged right now. They've gone years without strikes, years without pay increases. They sacrificed during the downturn to help to save the companies, and they feel that their sacrifices were not equal. A lot of the executives got bonuses for cost cutting during that period. That's particularly rankled a lot of people that, you know, they left pay on the table, whereas executives were, you know, got these big bonuses during the downturn, and now they're looking to kind of share in the company's prosperity now that both companies are prosperous again. And so a strike is still definitely possible, but the union leadership at the negotiating table has been reporting more progress, and that both companies have kind of been coming around a little bit and backing off some of the more proposals. As USW put it, some of the worst proposals they put forward, as far as just, you know, saddling these, you know, workers with thousands of dollars a year in premiums and deductibles and so forth for their health care. And it seems to be backing off the verge of it, but it's really too early to say until they put forward an agreement for ratification votes. You know, these things could turn at any time, and it's in no way like a done deal yet.
That's Times Business reporter Joseph Pete from last fall, when the steelmakers were still working things out with their labor unions. It was an overall effort that proved to be successful. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana Dunes National Park celebrating its new designation, making the occasion known by the renaming ceremony today and the continuing exhibit that's being set up at the Indiana Welcome Center in Hammond. And Superintendent Paul Labovitz talked with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about it.
A lot of very exciting things happening at Indiana Dunes National Park, being that it's now a national park. And I know that you're marking the occasion with several notable celebrations. You're having a there was a renaming ceremony, or is that still, that's coming up, right?
It's coming up on Tuesday. The governor, Congressman Pete Pasklowski, and our two U.S. senators, Senator Young and Senator Braun, are going to help unveil a sign with our new name.
And the National Park is celebrating the redesignation with an indoor exhibit, 61. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority there on Indianapolis Boulevard in Lake County have graciously allowed us to work with their team to put an exhibit in their exhibit hall. I think it's over 6,000 square feet of exhibit space of the variety of things you can experience here at Indiana Dunes National Park.
So what's going to go into the exhibit, and what are the things that are going to be highlighted?
You know, you try to do a little bit of everything that you can see and do here. So there are exhibits about our trails, there are exhibits about the lakes, There's an exhibit about plants and animals. I saw a picture of a truck bringing sand into the exhibit hall. Some of our cultural resources, like the Bailey Homestead and the Century of Progress Homes, you know, a little bit of everything, which, you know, is what the national park here is all about.
That's quite a list. I mean, could people get all of those attractions done in one day?
Well, you'll be able to do it at the South Shore CVA's Visitor Center because the exhibit's going to be a teaser. No, you could not do all those things in one day. And that's the point of just to let people know that, especially for folks who live close to here, that this is the kind of place that you want to keep coming back to and experiencing a different part of the park, whether it's the great beaches on Lake Michigan or a real special place like Pinhook Bog that is further away from the lake, but a pretty spectacular collection of bog, plants, and just beautiful scenery.
So give us the Cliff Notes version. This has been a long time coming. How did Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore become Indiana Dunes National Park?
It's a story that's about 103 years old. When the National Park system was first established in 1916, the first director was a Chicago businessman named Stephen Mather. And he had proposed an idea back in 1916 to create what he had called Indiana Sand Dunes National Park. And, you know, World War I was underway. The state of Indiana decided to do some industrial development, and the conservation community spent an additional 50 years trying to put the political support together to create a national park here. So in 1966, as part of the deal that created the Port of Indiana, the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore was established. And then, you know, for 53 years, the park as a lakeshore delivered great public experiences. And the beginning of this year, in early mid-February, the Indiana Congressional delegation was able to get the name changed to National Park. And it's been a bit of a rebirth, even though the change doesn't change the budget or the regulatory authorities of the park. But the recognition of that name is perceived internationally to be special, and so people are coming here and visiting the new national park from all over the place, really. It's been fun.
Are you already seeing an increase in visitors?
We are. I don't have numbers, but I know anecdotally from our visitor centers, people are coming in to get their national park passport stamp that says Indiana Dunes National Park. A lot of people, when they visit a national park site, and there are 419 national park sites, will get a stamp that's similar in style, but with the name and the date of the visit of the park they're at, and they collect them. And so we, for years, had the National Lakeshore stamp, and now we have a national park stamp.
So it's the attractions at the national park. That's the stamp, because there's 61 national parks. You said 419 of 419 attractions?
Well, there are 419 national park sites in the national park system. 61 of those, and this is where the 61 exhibit comes into play, are named national parks. Some are national lakeshores, national rivers, national battlefields, national seashores, national monuments. There's over 20-some different names of national park sites. They all have passports, stamps.
Because the place is the same, so what's the difference really?
Well, I kid people. I tell people that our signs are cheaper because there's less letters in them.
Cheaper printing, definitely.
Yeah, cheaper production for signs. No, nothing has changed but the name. But as I mentioned, perceptually, people think of the title National Park as really being something extra special. We're quick to tell people that all those 419 national park sites are extra special. But, you know, you got to play to the market, and when the market wants to talk about just the 61 national parks, it's really nice to be on that list.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we are, and we hope to benefit not just as a park, but as a region and all the other businesses and attractions that serve our residents and our visitors, and that this increase will be a good thing for us all.
I was just going to ask you about that. How do you think it's going to affect the area, the surrounding area, Northwest Indiana, economically?
Well, see, I tell people that the park, both the Indiana Dunes National Park and state parks, are the number one tourist attraction in Indiana, and through a variety of economic studies, seem to be responsible for upwards of $500 million of economic activity in the region per year. And so, you know, we're part of the complex equation of what makes this a great place to live, work, and play. And those of us who live here know that. And when visitors come here, whatever their impression is of Northwest Indiana, having never been here, they leave somewhat blown away about how wonderful it is.
Where do people come from to visit the national park and what obviously was once Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore? Do they come from everywhere in the world?
Yeah, I mean, a large percentage of our visitors come from the region, South, you know, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois. But literally, there are people from all over the country and the world who come here throughout the year. Our visitor center has a little map that shows where people are from, and they're literally from all over the world.
Is there any way you can elaborate a little bit more on how economically Northwest Indiana will benefit from this designation?
Well, yeah, obviously the number of people who come here and visit and spend money on lodging and food and entertainment is an obvious benefit. But for the people who live here, at some point, the value of private property that's near the park tends to increase because there is a park here. And those real estate values, as they increase the generation of taxes for the municipality so that they can do more in their communities. Almost incalculable, I can hardly say that, is that because of this open space here, we produce a lot of clean water and clean air, a place for people to come and relax and refresh. And so what is the economic value of a healthy place like that? It's hard to put a number to it.
Talking with Paul Labovitz, the superintendent of Indiana Dunes National Park. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks, Sharon. Good to talk with you.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson.
Coming up on July 13th, to be held in the town of Highland, is going to be the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event. It's being billed as a one-day, family-friendly, LGBTQ+ supportive festival. And the organizations that are putting all this together include the LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and PFLAG Crown Point and Pride Events Incorporated organizations. And we have with us the two people that are organizing and running both of these organizations, as well as the big event coming up this summer. Amari Victoria is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, and Elizabeth Manning is the president of PFLAG Crown Point, which is a support group organization. We'll find out more about that shortly. And also with the Pride Events Incorporated, which is an organization you all set up to help get the Pride event underway. Thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay. Well, first, Amari, if you will, tell us the involvement that you have, a personal as well as, I guess, in a way, a support group and professional feeling that you have about helping organize not only what you've done for the group that you help support, LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, but also the idea of having the very first Northwest Indiana Pride.
Thank you, Chris. My organization, LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, was formed after I discovered that there was really no support in Northwest Indiana for transgender folks like myself. And I decided that I needed to have support that was local, more local than a two-hour car ride away from our hometown of Crown Point. So I formed LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and started a transgender support group, as well as a discussion group for parents and guardians of transgender children. Those have been going on for almost a year now on a monthly basis. And that the fact that there was no support here also meant that there were no services that I could find.
Elizabeth, how do you fit into the picture now?
So I'm Amari's spouse, and we got married before she discovered she was transgender. When she discovered that, of course, I was going to stick by her side and go through the journey with her. As we were looking for support, as she mentioned, there were no places in Northwest Indiana. We were traveling to Goshen or to Michigan City. They have a great PFLAG chapter there, and found them very inspirational as well as helpful. So I turned to her one day and said, you know, I want to start a transgender support group in our area. And she said, no, you can't. Mm-hmm. I said, why? She said, because I'm going to. So she did. And then I started a PFLAG chapter, which is designed to support the families, friends, allies, and members of the LGBTQ community.
I guess, and PFLAG has been around, it's national, of course, and it's been around here in the region for some time, at least in other states. Besides the fact that there was no local chapter, prompted you to decide to get PFLAG going here in the region?
Well, there are not many spouses that stay with people once those people come out as transgender, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of confusion about, especially among parents who have children, and it is crucial to be accepted by family and friends and schoolmates and teachers, because if kids aren't supported, There is just such a terrible suicide rate. And just to be able to help people understand what the LGBTQ world is and be able to accept everybody as equal individuals, I think it was just, it's become a burning passion of mine, as it is Amari's.
Let's talk about LGBTQ Northwest Indiana and getting that organization started. What does it offer to residents here in the area that are interested, are inquisitive, but want to get involved?
Well, besides the support groups, which are already established, mm-hmm. I feel that education is extremely important, not only for people within the LGBTQ community, but the community at large. So I have been co-hosts or presented various educational topics. A couple of suicide prevention workshops were performed with in conjunction with Geminis Regional Health Systems. And my doctor, who is located in Goshen, Indiana, has been out here in Northwest Indiana to present two different health-related topics, one about hormone replacement therapy for transgender people and another about sensitivity and awareness for the medical profession and healing arts professions.
I know that your intent is to be able to bring to the general public a view of what the LGBTQ community is here in Northwest Indiana. It's education as well as entertainment, I guess you could say. Let's talk a little bit first what's going to be planned here for the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event in Highland this summer. And where does first the educational aspect come in?
Well, the educational aspect would come in that we have a variety of vendors who will be at the event that will be promoting their services in Northwest Indiana, some of them for the general public, but most of them also focusing on the LGBTQ community. Health services and mental health services are very important in the area for our community.
We're going to be offering free health screenings for people. As people come in, we're going to have some information about the gender spectrum, the gender identity, sexual orientation, and gender expression, the differences between that. So there'll be posters around and some displays and different booths handing out information so they can stop by and see all that.
Now, we talked about education, and then, of course, we mentioned entertainment. That probably comes in many facets. Tell us at least what's planned now for happening during the very first Northwest Indiana Pride when it comes to entertainment.
Okay, I'm going to tell you about our headliner musical act. That is the Brian Carmona Band. And he's just wonderful blues and rock, modern rock, classic rock. With a twist. He blends in a lot of R&B and soul with his music, and we're very happy to have him as our headlining musical act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have some drag shows lined up, both family-friendly during the day and then an adult drag show during the after party. Drag Kings are also going to be there. We've got another band. We'll have a Zumba class. We have a poetry reading or story reading, basically spoken word session. And we actually do have some weddings and vow renewals that'll be taking place,
oh, really?
As well as kids' entertainment.
Well, that's great. Now, when you mentioned it's a point I'm sure is going to bring people's attention right to what you mentioned about drag shows, and you told like a family-friendly drag show. That's interesting. How would you define that for somebody that is not aware of what that would be?
So a family-friendly drag show means that the language is proper, mm-hmm. and the displays are not risque, and the clothing is not risque. It'll be entertaining, you know, for the children. It'll be at a level where they can enjoy it. More of the kind of glam style or Vegas style type of drag show during the day.
Have you found in talking with people, and as you're getting the event organized for this summer, that maybe when you mentioned, well, this is what we have lined up, what we'd like to do, some of the events and the activities, you have music and you have the poetry readings, and now you mentioned that when you get to the other entertainment events too, people kind of give you a strange look as to what's this all about? Or do you think that maybe people in Northwest Indiana are becoming a bit more familiar of this?
Well, as far as drag shows are concerned, I believe that most people probably know what they are. Mm-hmm. RuPaul's Drag Race on TV probably helps that out a bit. I think the opinions of drag performers is mixed. But we hope to at least get across to the general public that drag shows are meant to be entertaining.
When you talk about some of the other things, you talk about a wide variety of genres of music and the like, and you talk about the poetry readings and all too. Do you think that this is going to be a surprise to anybody that happens to attend the event in July?
I think some of it will be a surprise. The reactions we've been getting when talking to local businesses and individuals has been surprisingly and pleasingly positive. Mm-hmm. They're excited that this is coming to Northwest Indiana. We've got a great DJ lined up, too, who's going to help us coordinate all these performers and the music. Colorblind celebrations. And I think that it's just going to be a lot of fun for people.
You have mentioned about the fact that you do have a lot of support from organizations and from businesses and the like here in the region as you get things organized here. And you mentioned that you've gotten a lot of support, at least mentioned so far, in doing so. How much work would you say it has become since this is your very first event, although you've done other, I'm sure, fundraisers and the like. In fact, you had a fundraiser just not long ago, mm-hmm. and you have more planned in advance of the Pride event coming up in July. But on a scale, we'll say, that ranges from putting on a bake sale to doing the Gary Ayer show, where do you think that, at least right now, what the NWI Pride seems to range on that scale?
I believe our estimate right now would hang a lot closer to the air show.
Especially personally.
It is unbelievable how many facets there are involved in putting together a show of this size, mm-hmm. an event of this size.
Do you think that since you're doing a lot of this work yourself and doing a lot of the organizing yourself, is it helping to have such good support out there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do have a good planning team to help us through these ventures. We wish we had a bigger planning team at this point.
Well, do you think that might change maybe with future events, that the more people here attend in July, see what it's all about, and when it's time to look for planning future Northwest Indiana Pride events, that it's gonna pick up with the support as well as the helpers that will help make it possible?
We believe so. This is meant to be a community event, and we hope to bring together mm-hmm. both members of the LGBTQ plus community as well as the community at large to see that we are no different from each other. We are all people who work and play in this area, Northwest Indiana, and that what we're doing is good for the community. We hope mm-hmm. that we will have people coming to us and saying we'd like to help.
All our organizations build a thriving and robust LGBTQ and ally community in this area. Mm-hmm. And this area, I mean the 5-county region that Wikipedia defines Northwest Indiana to be, Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Newton, Jasper counties. And there will be many, many opportunities for volunteer work during the event. And we're hoping to build a good volunteer base as well that can help us throughout the year as we do other events.
Now, if anybody is interested in finding out more about this very first, what hopes to be a series of annual Northwest Indiana Pride events happening this year, happening at the Lincoln Community Center in Highland, where can people find out more? And if they'd like to get involved, even though you're through into the planning process already, where they can get a hold of you to show you their support?
I think the best way for people to see what's going on and contact us would be to go to our website, www.nwi-pride.org.
We're talking with Amari Victoria, who is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, and with Elizabeth Menning, who is the president of PFLAG Crown Point and also the CEO of Pride Events Incorporated. And they together and others in their team are helping put together the very first annual Northwest Indiana Pride event, which is going to be happening in July, on July 13th. And it's a one-day event that's going to be held at the Lincoln Community Center in Highland. And ladies, thank you for joining us and telling us about it.
Thank you very much, Chris.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Race was never discussed around me. Nobody in the block would ever talk about this. That's what's so strange about Gary. There were no signs, whites only, blacks only, but it was like there was an iron curtain there that you just didn't penetrate. But in 1968, a Valpo law graduate named Richard Hatcher, a black man, got elected mayor of Gary. And I'll tell you exactly what happened, because it happened on my block, and it happened on every block in Glen Park. Almost immediately after this guy got elected, for sale signs up, there was this huge flood of people that left to flee to Portage, Valparaiso, Merrillville. People were concerned property values would go down. And there was a great fear that pent-up resentment from black people was going to spill forth in terms of violence against whites. What was 100% white area, I would say it was 75% black. My street turned into just a ghetto. I went down there a couple years ago. It really is scary. Any house that isn't boarded up are just a mess. They need paint. There's debris in the yard. You might see a car in a front yard all rusted out. Truthfully, I wouldn't get out of my car in my block now. It just looks rough, like something could happen. But in 1968, we moved to Miller Beach. Lily White, Miller Beach. My street now, where I used to live there in Miller, it's 90% black. However, that house in Miller Beach looks better now than when we lived in it. So it isn't necessarily true that if black people move in, they will destroy. Didn't happen in our Miller neighborhood. Why it happened in Glen Park, I don't know. I would like people to understand that it is actually possible for something so wrong to go on with everybody just assuming it's normal. I know you get busy doing other things. I certainly did. I'm guilty of not taking a very active role in change. But listen to the way this situation was handled in Gary, Northwest Indiana. Everything would have been fine in Gary if people would have just calmed down. He got elected and it was like, we don't want to talk. We just want to run.
And you can find more stories online at welcomeprojectoneword.valpo.edu. Preparing for the birth of a child can be one of the most blissful times in the life of a family. But sadly, for thousands of expectant mothers every year, infant loss can turn that bliss into tragedy with very little warning. Statistics show that 1 in 4 women experience pregnancy or infant loss. It's a pain that many parents understand, but one that is sadly ignored in society these days.
When President Ronald Reagan announced the existence of Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month in 1988, he said in a speech, "When a child loses his parent, they are called an orphan. When a spouse loses her or his partner, they are called a widow or widower. When a parent loses their child, there isn't a word to describe them." Sadly, infant loss is a pain that many parents in the region understand, but one that society too often minimizes or ignores. Amelia Kowalison founded Emma's Footprints following the loss of her daughter, Emma Rose, in 2014. Amelia, can you take a few moments to share with us your journey to start Emma's Footprints?
Well, our journey started in 2014, after our twins Alex and Emma were born prematurely at 31 weeks. They were immediately taken to the NICU at Porter Regional Hospital, and at about a week old, we found out that Emma had a severe stroke in utero. So we had her transferred to Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis, and Alex actually was not able to go there, so he had to remain at Porter while he finished up his care. What happened is that while we were at Riley Children's Hospital, we received numerous care packages from people all over, and it was so kind and so touching. My husband and I literally cried every time. We were just so blessed by what these people did. And so when Emma passed away at 23 days old, in lieu of flowers at her funeral, we asked people to bring care package items so that we could do this one-time act of kindness to provide that love to families at Porter. Well, what happened is that one-time act of kindness just grew and grew and grew, and all of a sudden we had basically a house full of donations and items, and the funeral home had been full of donations and items. So we reached out to a local attorney, we set up a fund, and we established our organization, Emma's Footprints, with another organization out here underneath their underneath them. And over the past four, almost 5 years, our organization has grown so much. Our community has been so loving and grateful to us that we are now our own established 501c3 as of a few months ago, which is very, very exciting. We are now providing care packages, NICU care packages, to all of the NICUs in our area, as well as Riley Children's Hospital and Beacon Health in South Bend. We have helped Lurie Children's Hospital. We provide our bereavement bears, which are bears that when family goes through a miscarriage or infant loss, they can take home with them so they're not leaving empty-handed. We have bereavement care packages on our website, www.emmasfootprints.org, that people can order and have sent to people. We also have a new product that we just launched, which is our rainbow baby care packages for families that are pregnant again after loss. And then we also have we have four support groups in our area, two in Porter County and two in Lake County for NICU families. We are working on workshops, which we've done in the past and we want to bring back. We have our Mother's Day event, which we actually just had this past weekend. We were able to pamper and love on about 130 women who have experienced pregnancy, infant loss, or having a child in the NICU. There were masseuse, hairstylist, makeup artist. We had amazing speakers. We had a photo booth going. There was a photographer taking flower crown photos, which people are going to be sharing with us, and we will be putting in a book along with their story about finding hope after loss or the trauma of having a child in the NICU. And we just continue to do whatever we can to support and help families in our community and beyond.
For families experiencing pregnancy or infant loss, having the time to say goodbye can be a very important step as they try to make sense out of what has happened. How has your organization helped during this time? Now, I understand you have counselors on your team.
Well, the counselors that we have, we're not actually counselors, so I want to just clarify that. It's peer support that we provide. So we have families, mothers that have experienced this as well, that will walk with you through your journey. The person that we do have right now as our bereavement care team leader is Michelle, and she runs another company called Juno's Promise, which is a doula organization that helps families through stillbirth and through the pregnancy and birth of a rainbow baby. We are hoping, once we have an office in the near future, to have an actual therapist on staff. And that's one of our big goals to have. But another way that we support families is that every hospital in our area has something called a cuddle cot for when a family experiences a child born still. And what that cuddle cot does is that it keeps the baby's temperature at what it needs to be so the family can have more time with them, so that family can come in and meet the child so they can take pictures, so they can bathe the child and have those moments that studies have shown really prove to help the family through their journey. We provided those about 3 years ago. Another thing that we have for our NICU families is that we have the peer-led support groups. So we have these two wonderful ladies, Brittany and Taryn. Brittany is our NICU care team leader, and she runs our Lake County ones, one at St. Anthony's in Crown Point, and then another one at a pizzeria in Crown Point, and then Carriage Pizza in Crown Point. And then Taryn runs one at Porter Hospital and then at a Starbucks here in Valpo. And so those have been really helpful for our families in the NICU or who have had a child in the NICU. And then we also provide a ton of online support. We have a pregnancy after loss group. We have a NICU support group. We have a bereavement group. We provide articles and resources. And we just do whatever we can to help families in their time of need, just as we would want to be helped. We're here, you know, we're here 24/7. There's always one of us that can be here, and it can be at the hospital if a family needs us, which we do. We've helped plan funerals. We go in and we have pictures taken of the children. We will provide meals and to help families when they need us.
What would you tell those who have suffered a loss but don't know where to turn?
You know, I have that question a lot, and I always say just walk with that family. Be there. Dig your toes in deep and let them know that you're there. Don't walk away. Support them. Remember that child. Let them talk. Let them grieve how they need to. Don't put a timeline on them. I think Bringing a meal is always wonderful. Talking about their child. Don't be afraid to say their child's name, because they're never going to forget their child. They're never going to forget that they had that child. That child is always a part of them. It makes my heart so happy whenever someone says Emma's name. So I would say just continue to let their child live through you and just honor that family by honoring their child and honoring their feelings, and always, always offer grace, because once you lose a child, you are a different person. There's so much of you that has changed, and it's a different journey in life that you're now going through. So that grace is so, so important.
And finally, Amelia, how can lost parents and their families get in contact with Emma's Footprints?
Well, they can find us on Facebook at Emma K's Footprints, or they can find us at Instagram at Emma's Footprints IN. So you can reach out to us at info@emmasfootprints.org, or they can call us at 219-299-9246.
Amelia Kowalison is the founder of Emma's Footprints. Emma's Footprints is an organization with a goal to sustain lost parents and their families through the fog of grief and care for them in every stage of healing and hope after loss.
And that's Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you'll be with us tomorrow.